Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are few people better equipped to provide such a briefing, an unclassified one to be sure, but a very informed and thoughtful one nonetheless, is our guest for this full hour, I'm very pleased to say. His name is Captain James Fennell, United States Navy retired. He is a trained and highly accomplished naval intelligence officer, serving for some 30 years in the uniform of the Navy, and rising, among other things, to serve as the Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence for the U.S. 7th Fleet, the Pacific Fleet of the United States Navy. He has a distinguished curriculum vitae, as they say, of academic training, both at the undergraduate level and graduate levels, including at the Air Command and Staff College, where he received a Master's of Arts in Military Science. He has published extensively in naval professional journals of various kinds, and one of the great services that he provides is he monitors closely and shares with many of us the fruits of his research into the daily output of the Chinese propaganda instruments and other media. He tracks these things with care. He provides very, very helpful commentary, and he's just a real extraordinary resource, a national treasure is the way I think of him. And it's a delight to have him with us always as a guest. Captain Fennell, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Thank you for joining us today. I want to start, Jim, if I can, with what I know you have been tracking very closely, which is both what's actually happening with respect to this coronavirus 19, I think of it as the Chinese Communist Party, or CCP virus, but whatever one calls it, I'm interested in your best judgment as to what's actually happening on the ground in China with respect to this virus. And how reliable is the data that the Chinese Communist Party has been providing us about the state of affairs there?
Sure, Frank. I think what's going on now regarding this virus, which you accurately described as the Chinese Communist Party's virus, has really, as we all know, reached around the globe. And China's numbers and what they're reporting every day, which they've been putting on their press organs, like China Daily, every day they have an email that goes out or an article that goes out that lists the numbers of infected, the numbers of new cases, the numbers of deaths, et cetera. So the numbers that we're seeing from China are really an attempt by China to manipulate the situation and create this perception that China has been actually the recipient of imported cases from the virus that was being imported back into China from foreign destinations like the UK or Italy. And they track now on a daily basis imported cases back into China as if they're being on the receiving end. And as we just saw yesterday or last night in China, they've gone out and restricted all flights, returnees, foreign visitors from coming back into China. So something that they criticized President Trump on the 31st of January, when President Trump put a ban on Chinese air travel back into the United States, they condemned that vociferously for the last month and a half, month and three quarters. And now they're doing the exact same thing. But they're trying to create this atmosphere that that because of their measures of control, which we accurately describe in many circles as being very draconian, they're describing this as the only true solution for gaining control of the virus in China and that the rest of the world should adopt their policies.
Yeah, I call this communism is a cure for the coronavirus. You know, seems as though this is implausible, but it's nonetheless their party line. And Jim, you mentioned they're talking about having people bring the disease into China. Of course, one of the narratives that they have promoted, and I think you tracked the genesis of this back to a report out of a Japanese newspaper, which I assume was planted by the Chinese there. But they've conjured up this entire false meme of the United States, specifically U.S. Army personnel participating in military games in Wuhan in October, being the original source of this. Tell us a bit about that and how that features in their party line now.
Yes, on March 12th, the foreign ministry, PRC foreign ministry spokesman, Zhao, tweeted out that the source of the virus was not from China, but actually came from an American military member who was part of the World Military Games that occurred in October of 2019 back in Wuhan. And so they've created this narrative he put this out there, that it was actually the United States that brought the virus to China. Obviously, President Trump got wind of this, and because this person was a foreign ministry spokesman, it took a little bit more seriousness than just being something posted on the Global Times or on some website in China. Immediately, the president started using the term Chinese virus, and that seemed to very much get Beijing's attention. And over the course of the next couple of weeks, what we saw was increasing rhetoric from China condemning the president for being a racist. And unfortunately, in our own press in America, people were jumping on that bandwagon and started labeling him as a racist. But I think really what it was, the president was taking a shot across the bow at the PRC to say, you better not try to create a false narrative that we created this. And interestingly enough, about 5 days ago, the Chinese stopped using it, and they started saying that it was Italy that actually brought the virus into China. And that was about 2 days later that President Trump stopped saying Chinese virus. And so I have to wonder if the president was able to either behind the scenes say something to Xi or somehow get their attention to say, if you really want to go there, we're going to go there, and we're going to really open this up for the rest of the world. And then you saw the Chinese shift, at least the Chinese party shift. And I think some of the Chinese people now, I'm seeing other, reports from other, nets that talk about Chinese perceptions of this. And some people on the average Chinese person are quite upset to see that their government has shifted the blame. You know, originally the Chinese government for weeks called it the Wuhan virus in their own PRC official press documents. And then it was the U.S. that caused it, and then it was Italy. And so I think China's got some egg on their face in terms of their credibility.
Jim Fennell, we need to pause for just a minute. When we come back, I want to visit further about some of the purposes for this propaganda that are very ominous, it seems to me, and perhaps also to pulse you on what you think might be the actual origin of the disease. Could it have been a biological weapons facility in Wuhan, China? That and much more with Captain James Fennell, United States Navy retired, a very accomplished intelligence professional with whom we're delighted to have a chance to visit. Also a member of the Committee on the Present Danger, China, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are spending this hour, an extraordinarily rich hour, I'm quite sure, talking with Jim Fennell. He is a retired United States Navy captain who specialized during the course of his 30 years of service in the uniform of the United States Navy in the intelligence business and has deep knowledge of the Indo-Pacific theater in particular and China most especially. Since he took off that uniform, he has remained very actively engaged in trying to teach the rest of us about what China is up to and to help us make sense of, well, the threat, the present and growing danger from China that we all must attend to. So, Jim, it's, again, very good to have you with us. We were talking in the previous segment, Jim, about what the Chinese have been saying to their own people, as well as the unreliable statistics that they've been putting out for the rest of the world about the condition of that population, afflicted as it is, first and foremost, by this Wuhan virus, the Chinese Communist Party virus, whatever you want to call it. You were just describing some of the propaganda that is now being used to try to deflect blame to the United States, and I want to talk about that in a moment. But before we do, just a quick question, Jim. You're a serious student of what the Chinese have been doing in their military arena. Is there a chance, as far as you're concerned, I'm not saying that it's proven at the moment by any means, but do you think there's a chance that the provenance of this virus was actually not a wet market in Wuhan, at least not initially, but a biological weapons facility located not too far away from it, the Institute of Virology, associated with what we're told is an active, covert, and illegal Chinese biological weapons program?
Yeah, Frank, I think we just don't know. And so I'm loath to make an assessment of definitive of how it started. But I think Senator Cotton has been quite correct in saying that we need to investigate this. And the and Secretary Pompeo has also said we need to have the international community of experts to be allowed to go into Wuhan and have access to the original source documents, clinical data, and lab results, and do the analysis. And that has not happened. And interestingly enough, the Chinese Center for Disease Control themselves, their national team from Beijing, when they went to Wuhan, did not get to see this original data and talk to the original doctors from Wuhan. And the Chinese admitted this in Global Times on the 24th of March, just a couple of days ago. So I think that the reality is, and my circle of people that I speak to, while you cannot rule out the possibility of a animal to human transmission and some kind of event at a wet market, there seems to be very little proof of that, real tangible proof. There's innuendo or suspicion that this is what caused it. But what seems more likely is that this BSL lab, this biosafety lab level 4, which is in Wuhan, the Chinese have a track record of failure to keep control over safety and security measures at facilities like this around their country, not just biosafety labs, but other kinds of facilities that deal with food safety and things of that nature, where standards are atrocious, especially when no one's watching.
Yeah, and including the sale of animals that have been actually used for experimentation. I can hardly imagine a more dangerous practice than that. And just, I guess, one quick question, again, as skilled intelligence professional who specialized in China, is there any doubt in your mind that there is, whether it was involved or not in this episode, an active biological weapons program in China that is illegal under its treaty obligations?
I am not up to speed on the legalities of this BSL-4 lab in Wuhan, but there is one there. There's no question about that. That's a fact.
And the question, I guess, is whether the military facility on which it is housed is part of that larger facility or larger, you know, capability. And we'll continue to be dogging that. But I think you're right. Senator Cotton has certainly pointed to that as a concern.
And the fact of the matter is that they're not allowing anybody in there to see this or touch it or get any kind of clinical, test data at all. So, I mean, why are they hiding that?
Yeah, it's extraordinary. Jim, so one other concern that I've had is that the idea that it was the United States that was responsible for this pandemic and all that it has done to the Chinese people, even if anybody who's been thinking about it realizes that that contradicts the party's own narrative prior to making this fabrication, but that the purpose for that might be to try to engage in a bit of social engineering, as it's called, to give the party some basis for trying to appeal to the public of China to rally around the flag, to perceive a foreign enemy, to resent this American power, and thereby perhaps create conditions for a military response of some kind somewhere, maybe against Taiwan. Your thoughts on that?
I think that's something that we need to keep in the back of our mind at all times. I mean, China and the PRC and the Communist Party speak repeatedly about comprehensive national power. And that combines all elements of power, which is economic, diplomatic, information, and military. And so when we see what China's doing in terms of their diplomatic effort to twist and turn and their information warfare campaign to twist and turn culpability for this virus killing and devastating so many people, we should not rule out the idea that there will be a military component to this. And that's why it's so incredibly important that our posture in the Pacific remain so strong and provide a credible deterrent to any kind of adventurism that the PRC would take. For instance, Taiwan right now has shown incredible capacity to essentially snuff this virus out of the island of Taiwan and the 23 million people that live there. And they're not doing it with the draconian measures that Beijing put on the province of Hubei and Wuhan and the rest of their nation. And so it's an affront to the power and the legitimacy of the CCP to watch a little tiny nation of Chinese people essentially succeed where the big Chinese Communist Party has failed. And so given their already aspirations to take Taiwan or restore Taiwan to, or I don't want to say restore because they never had it, but to take control of Taiwan as part of their belief system that it's part of China, who knows what they would use and how they would use an event like this to launch off an attack.
We're going to come back to that, Jim, shortly. I want to talk more with you about what the Chinese have been doing to give themselves the capacity to act in that fashion and more generally to threaten our vital interests in the Pacific. But before we do, I did want to salute you because one of the things that I received from you earlier this morning was a heads up about a very extraordinary reversal by an individual at the Imperial College in the United Kingdom in terms of estimates he had made about the likelihood of this pandemic being devastating to his own country, the United Kingdom, and to ours. Can you just give us a quick description of what this fellow Neil Ferguson has recently said?
Yes, Professor Neil Ferguson is an epidemiologist at the Imperial College of London. He wrote a paper several weeks ago that predicted that there would be millions and millions of deaths as a result of this virus spreading around the world. And he specifically noted that in the United Kingdom, there would probably be 500,000 people killed. And in the United States, 2.2 million people using these mortality rates that were, 2.5, 3.5, 4.5, 5.5. And so he had written this, and it essentially took root in the international medical community and drove, I think, a lot of the decision-making that was taken by many countries. Well, over the weekend or over the last couple of days, he has now modified what he said and said, now I've probably overestimated, and we think now that probably in the UK, death totals from this virus could be more likely to be 20,000, not 500,000.
It's not exactly a rounding error. And I think he also said that half of those would have died anyway because they were ill in the course of the year, right?
It wasn't just his one study or his retraction either. There's been two other studies from Oxford and from Stanford, two other studies, peer-reviewed studies that have come out that said that the way that numbers are being calculated by many research or many clinicians around the world are overreacting and doing worst-case analysis. And I'm loath to criticize people for doing worst-case analysis because that's what I did for a lot of my career in the military. But there's an unintended consequence when you make things like this and when you have now more and more data that shows that the results are not coming to fruition. I think it's very, very important that people are honest and transparent about the models so that we don't take counteractions, as the president said, are worse than the cure.
And this plays directly into the debate that is now going on inside this country, as you know, Jim Finnell, namely that the president is trying to talk about getting back into business. He's set a very ambitious goal of Easter, 12th of April. He's taking a lot of heat from that academic and medical community. But what I think this changed estimate demands really is a fresh look at not only the data that we've been operating on, but also some of the steps that we've taken. And as we speak, Jim, the United States Congress is about to throw trillions of dollars at this problem, setting in train some policies and programs that I think are going to be extraordinarily problematic. And it seems to me, at a minimum, there should be some clarity that we ought to be in a position before all of that money goes out the door, important as it may seem to some people at the moment, that we be able to revisit those policies and programs and expenditures before it is all said and done, in the expectation that maybe, just maybe, this may not be as bad as we've been told it will be. Jim, we're going to come back and we're going to talk more about what is the nature of the relationship between the United States and China at the moment, and particularly some of the things that you track so closely that ought to give us real pause and concern. That and much more with Captain Jim Finnell, United States Navy retired. You'll not want to miss this next segment particularly. Stay tuned.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a particularly warm welcome to our guest for this full hour, Captain James Finnell, United States Navy retired. We are taking stock with him of what has been happening lately as a result of a pandemic that emanated from China, propaganda line that the Chinese Communist Party, which is really responsible for this pandemic, has been using against us, and the implications if the kind of damage that has been done to our economy and arguably to our polity by the pandemic to date is something that has been excessive and unnecessary in light of the actual circumstances that we're facing. Jim, this leads me to the larger question of what China is up to. The stated ambitions of the Chinese Communist Party under Xi Jinping is probably the place to start. And I'd love to get your thoughts as to what we now know is the ambition of the Chinese Communist Party at the moment. And then we'll talk about some of the things that they're doing to try to translate that ambition into reality.
Yeah, Frank, I think we've talked about this before, but I mean, clearly Beijing has stated unequivocally that they are pursuing the China dream. And, you know, General Secretary Xi has said the China dream is the great rejuvenation of China, or the restoration of China to its rightful place in history. And these kinds of comments are not new to the Chinese Communist Party. We know that other emperors have said and considered the same kind of thing. Gordon Chang talks about China's pursuit of Tianxia, which is this everything under heaven and earth underneath the leaders of China. And so we now have the Chinese Communist Party pursuing that event after what they claim was 100 years of humiliation. And so for the last 30 years or more than 40 years since the reform and opening up that Deng brought in, China has been pursuing this goal of becoming the world's leader. And if you had said that 10 years ago, you would have been laughed out of the Pentagon or out of other halls of our government, because that just seemed too improbable. But it doesn't seem so improbable today. And given with what we're seeing from the Chinese, the way they're operating and controlling the diplomatic arena at the places like the UN, and what they're doing in the economic arena with the Belt and Road Initiative, or as a friend of mine calls it, the Belt and Road Vector, they are trying to get their hooks and tentacles into the existing world order and fundamentally transform it into something that they can control and manipulate. And a major area that I've been following, as you noted, is the military arena. And China has been essentially for 25 years building a modern, capable military and transforming not only just building pieces of hardware, but transforming the entire structure of their military organization, transforming the numbers of military regions from 7 to 5, reducing excess military capacities that were non-military related, like bands and shoe factories and things that had nothing to do with the military. They've swept all that away and cut it away, and they've focused on one thing, and that's warfighting. And they've built a space infrastructure to provide indications and warning and targeting data to their strategic rocket forces and to their military conventional forces that launch long-range, over-the-horizon cruise missiles that fly at supersonic speeds. They're developing hypersonic missiles that will even defeat our defense systems because we're not prepared yet to be able to track these things and destroy them. And so they're on a full frontal campaign across all elements of the military dimension, whether it's under the sea, on the sea, over the sea, in space, in air, in the cyber domain, to be able to dominate the U.S. military. And for the longest time, over the last 5 years, people have said, well, that's just so they can have regional dominance in the Western Pacific and inside those first and second island chains from Guam to the Ryukyu Islands and into the mainland of China. But what's become clear over the last couple of years, to me at least, and I probably should have been clear to me 20 years ago, but they have a global aspiration. And so we're now seeing Chinese military activities around the world. Their Navy has visited every area of the world on routine patrols. They just had an anti-piracy task group return back to Qingdao after 6 months at sea. And they visited, around the world, exercising with Russians, with South Africans, other groups of exercise in the Mediterranean, in the Baltic. Now they have assets in the Atlantic and the South Atlantic. And they're opening up in the economic arena ports in places in Africa, in the Middle East, and in Europe, where their military warships will be able to go in and resupply and have shelter in time of need. And this is just now. Where will that be in another 20 years or another 30 years?
This is a very ominous assessment, the purpose as well as the trajectory of the Chinese Navy as just one example of the larger buildup you've spoken about. They're also operating in the Arctic and Antarctic. And as you say, this Belt and Road vector is enabling these kinds of power projection capabilities worldwide and doing it on the cheap, no less, with these payday loans that they've been making and essentially the expropriation of much of the infrastructure, the ports, the airfields, the road networks, rail networks, and so on that they've been building on credit for countries that can't pay the debt. So when you put all this together, Jim, as a seasoned intelligence officer, a national security professional, does this indicate to you that we're reaching a kind of tipping point with respect to the Chinese, that at some point in the not too distant future, the kind of rhetoric that has accompanied this, including people talking about killing tens of thousands of American sailors by attacking U.S. carriers, may not simply be bellicose and empty threats, but actually the plan?
Frank, that is my greatest concern right now, is that we have essentially dismissed this potentiality that somebody could actually challenge the U.S. military. And that's up until this administration. Previous administrations from both sides of the aisle just never conceived that that could be possible. And there's a lot of reasons for it, and not really necessary to get into it. But the fact is, that's what happened. And now we're sitting in a situation where it's not just bellicose rhetoric, because we're actually seeing their warships and their planes circle around Taiwan in an increased periodicity and numbers of ships than we ever have before. They're using their warships to threaten and cajole smaller nations in the South China Sea, threaten Japan, prop up a dictator in North Korea with flights and things of that nature. So I think we need to be very, very careful that we are on the cusp, a precipice, as you said, of a tipping point. And we need to do something dramatically different in the way we approach this. And because it's largely a maritime domain that we're talking about when China projects power across the globe. Now, some of that's going to be in the rocket force and in their air forces, but the way that the Chinese have really invested the largest part of their riches has been in their Navy. And I think we need to be very, very concerned about what we're doing to be able to combat and confront a Chinese Navy, not just in the Western Pacific, but off our West Coast.
And indeed, as you've said, Jim, elsewhere as well. And I do want to salute, because you have been sounding, it may not be 20 years, but you certainly have been sounding this alarm since before you left the Navy. And to your great credit, I think you've been clear-eyed about it, and you've been helping others of us become equally concerned. Jim, let me ask you, as a man who served in the uniform of the United States Navy and who has these kinds of insights and understandable concerns, what do you think about the idea that this federal retirement system, into which people like you have contributed your retirement funds, both in uniform and civilian government employees of the federal government, might now be compelled by a decision by the Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board to invest those funds, or at least some of them, in companies the Chinese are using to build the very weapons you've just been warning about?
Well, Frank, it's reprehensible to think that money from retired U.S. military and other retired U.S. government workers would go into the Chinese Communist Party, where they have prioritized spending on military hardware and military systems, weapon systems and information technologies to kill American military personnel. To think that our money would go into those coffers to be provided to them to kill us is just, it's absolutely incomprehensible that any person in the United States government could justify this for any reason. And I don't care about this idea, or not idea, but the claim that, well, we're looking for the best return on your dollar. Well, as an American citizen and as an American military veteran, I don't want that kind of return on my dollar. I will take a less return.
It's actually obscene, I think, not just reprehensible, but it, whatever you call it, it shouldn't happen. And let me just say two things. One is, it is perilously close to happening. It will be involving not just the funds of retirees like yourself, but active duty personnel whose retirement funds are being invested in the Thrift Savings Plan. And it doesn't necessarily assure that we're going to get the best return on investment. In fact, the man managing those funds, a fellow by the name of Larry Fink, I've come to call him Year of the Rat Fink, is made it very clear that he does not care about return on investment. Nothing's more important to him, he says, with his investments than the companies that he controls, than that they put that money where it will advance environment, social justice, and governance concerns. Never mind that the Chinese don't qualify on any of those counts. He's nonetheless putting money from the MSCI and other funds into those sorts of companies that are posing the threats that we've just discussed. Jim Fennell, we're going to pause for one last moment, and when we come back, I want to talk to you about what the United States must be doing in the face of these various threat vectors from communist China. That and more with Captain Jim Fennell, United States Navy retired. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to the fourth and final installment of this extraordinarily important conversation with one of our country's leading thinkers about and monitors of the dangers that we're facing, the present and growing dangers, as I like to think of it, from the Chinese Communist Party. His name is Captain James Fennell. He is a retired United States Naval Intelligence Officer of great distinction, both from his time in uniform and the service that he's rendering these days. He is forward deployed in Europe and has eyes on a lot of what's happening in that environment. We're anxious to sort of take stock with him about the various threat vectors, some of which we've touched upon, that he is perceiving need our strong and careful and successful response. Jim, I was very keen to talk further about some of these non-military threat vectors and to get your ideas about what we might do about them. We've talked about the Belt and Road Initiative. It is reaching up, as you know, into Europe, particularly what I think of as sort of the digital infrastructure counterpart to those ports and airfields and so on that we discussed a moment ago. Talk to us about 5G. What's happening as you see it on the ground at the hands of the Chinese Communist Party and Huawei, and the effect that it's having on our alliances, as well as potentially the future security of Europe, and what we should be doing about it.
Well, Frank, I think this debate over 5G, it gets down to the issue of, you know, what's going to be the future of the world in terms of the kind of the currency of the world, and that is data and information. And we're already kind of there, but 5G offers up a new arena in terms of a new paradigm, if you will, of the importance of connecting all of the things that we use on a daily basis, not just our smartphones with our computers, but the things that we use to do business, the tools that we use, the things that monitor our heart rates, the things that doctors will use to do remote telemedicine and teleoperations, banking, all of these kinds of things are going to be connected in a new world under the 5G. And it looks like China with Huawei and ZTE are controlling a major portion of the global supply of these pieces of hardware and technology and software. And they've gotten ahead of the United States, and we need to be concerned about that because their control of these systems, while they say is a benign thing and just part of the market, we need to look at how they use data inside their own lifelines in the PRC and how they are treating their own citizens, whether it's in Tibet or Xinjiang, the social credit system, or what they're even doing now with the virus, where they're actually, you know, tracking people's every move, monitoring people with remotely controlled drones that are flying around the cities to make sure that people are not outside without a mask. And if you are, you'll be hounded and harassed, and policeman Vector defines you and arrests you and throw you in prison.
And not least, we're seeing the next step, that you're only really going to be allowed out and about as China returns to business if you have essentially gotten your social credit system or your health score, if you will, approved by this same kind of Orwellian data mining and surveillance state apparatus, no?
That's exactly right. And what's interesting is that the majority of the tests that are going on in China over this virus aren't the kinds of, nucleic acid tests that our tests are using, as the president talks about, the most advanced tests and the most accurate. They're using these, temperature gauges, and these temperature gauge tests that they put to a forehead, as we've heard from many people, are very, very inaccurate. So the idea that there's going to be some kind of review process and people that aren't considered to have the virus, that don't have the virus. I mean, there's a huge rooms of air there where it's easier to just throw people in jail and isolate them than to consider their human rights and their basic civil rights. And it's scary.
It is scary. And so is the idea that the Chinese are finding ways to fracture our alliances by getting 5G inside our allies' telecommunications networks. And as you know better than most, Jim, making unsecure the kinds of intelligence sharing links that we have relied upon in the past. So I would like to ask, just sort of give us what you would tell President Trump, if you had his ear, we should be doing now. In the wake of this pandemic, the insights that it's given us about what the Chinese are up to, the kinds of changes that it has made possible and things that might not otherwise have been, like ending our reliance on Chinese supply chains and really being clear-eyed about the threat, what should we be doing now?
Well, Frank, I think you laid out the proper, architecture for where we need to be viewing China. China is an adversary. They're no longer a competitor. They are an adversary that wants to displace the United States as a leader of the world. And they would prefer not to do it by shooting missiles and bombs at us, but they would prefer to do it by getting inside of our political structure, our diplomatic structure, our the way we communicate, the way we think and operate. And they've done that. We know the world has all heard about the fact that all of our medicine is produced in China. We need to bring these critical things back to America. And I would say, as we look at the medicine area, the medical, pharmaceutical arena, and everybody's kind of fixated on that, apply that mentality of skepticism and concern to the other areas. Can we build enough warships and warplanes and satellites and network topology and things of that nature in America so that we can be self-sufficient? Because I know it's not popular to say this here in Europe because there's a big bent for globalization and everybody working together. But the fact of the matter is that the Westphalian nation state structure has not stopped. And that is still the best guarantor of American citizen safety and security. And we need to bring back productivity and the ability to defend ourselves by producing things ourselves. And we've been blessed with a great country that has the natural resources that will allow us to do this. And we need to move in that direction. And we can go there with our allies. We have friends and allies, and we can work and trade with them. So I'm not suggesting that we completely isolate. I'm not an isolationist. I spent almost 30 years overseas working with my friends and partners in various Asian allied nations. So I'm all about allies, but we do not need to be reliant upon the People's Republic of China for anything that deals with our national security. And we need to cut those cords. And that's going to require the president to make it more clear to the government and the state, that the federal government that runs many of these things, that we are no longer partners and friends with China, and that we need to start decoupling in these critical areas.
I think he's doing that with fairly consistent and effective rhetoric. The next step is, of course, the implementation. And you're right, he does need to get the buy-in of the U.S. government, because it seems largely under the sway of the globalists or the engagement champions. And I don't think there's anybody in the United States, Jim, who's been a more effective challenger of that proposition. And I salute you for that. Leslie, and very quickly, the Chinese Communist Party has clearly been rocked internally by its performance on this pandemic. And I think the resistance to it has been remarkable. Should we be challenging, as Ronald Reagan did, the Soviet evil empire, the legitimacy and the preeminence of the Chinese Communist Party as one of the other steps that we take at this time?
Yes, we should. And I think President Trump has shown great skill in that. Referring to President Xi as his friend, I think, is a way to try to, I don't think he's saying he's friends with the Chinese Communist Party, but he's trying to send a signal that people in the United States don't hate or despise Chinese people. I think there's a point where we need to start specifically focusing on the Chinese Communist Party and the values and the ideology of the party. Maybe you can even separate Xi from that. I'm not sure how you do that, but maybe that's a way to keep getting the word in. But we need to start sending those messages in, that this is an ideological struggle and an ideological difference, and that what they believe in is a slavery, and what we believe in is freedom and liberty. And those are easy to show in this COVID-19 or Wuhan virus environment.
Tim, we have to leave it at that. I think Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is doing an admirable job of challenging the Chinese Communist Party. I think the president can do more of that as well. But I think this is an important vector for us, in addition to the others that you've mentioned. Thank you for your time, as well as your great insights, Jim Fennell. I hope you will not only stay well, but also be very much a frequent guest of ours in the course of these important months ahead. This topic deserves and requires the attention that we give it. Bless you, sir. Talk to you soon. I hope the rest of you will join us again on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.